Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. America is undergoing profound change. Demographic transformation, shifting global power dynamics, and a foreign policy establishment in transition are reshaping how the United States sees itself and how the world responds. These shifts raise some fundamental questions. What does a more diverse America mean for its global role? As new voices emerge, how do long-standing foreign policy elites adapt, or will they lose influence? Given all these factors, how has the second Trump administration differed in its foreign policy making? And how are rapid technological changes, including AI, reframing global governance? To explore these issues, in November 2025, I spoke to Professor Anne-Marie Slaughter, CEO of New America and a leading thinker on global governance, democracy, and U.S. foreign policy. Our conversation ranged from demographic upheaval to America's evolving relationship with global partners, the legacy of East Coast foreign policy elites, and the challenges America faces in its 250th anniversary year. I began our conversation by asking Anne-Marie Slaughter to introduce herself and outline the big questions driving her current work.
I'm Anne-Marie Slaughter. I'm the CEO of New America, which is a think and action tank headquartered in Washington, but with work across the United States and some globally. I have a background as a professor, a law professor, a dean, a government official, and foreign policy. And today I work on lots of things, including American domestic politics. But globally, I am thinking very hard about what the global order of the 21st century should look like, can look like, will look like. I'm not certain anybody knows, but how do we solve existential global problems?
So your talk today at LSE is titled America Adrift, the End of the East Coast Foreign Policy Elite. And in part, it looks at demographic change in America. Could you give our listeners a brief overview of the types of demographic trends the U.S. is currently facing and how they might impact the country both politically and socially? Thank you.
The first thing I should say is that I am not suggesting that because the East Coast foreign policy elite has declined, America is automatically adrift. I do not necessarily think that the stewardship of any particular group of people is better or worse because of their identity. But through the 20th century, and certainly the second half of the 20th century, which is my lifetime, mostly the Cold War, the stewards of American foreign policy, the establishment, as we would call them, the members of the Council on Foreign Relations is often used as a proxy. These are overwhelmingly white people, really 95%. They are largely East Coast, and if they weren't actually born on the East Coast, they are typically educated on the East Coast. They look to Europe. That is where their families and their heritage, cultural heritage, is from. They also often are educated in part in Europe, or in the earlier part of the 20th century would have been the Grand Tour, that Europe is the home of Western civilization. There are a lot of assumptions encoded in all of that. And the American-European 20th century experience, of course, is shaped by two world wars and then the Cold War, in which the United States and parts of Europe have been allied, fighting dictatorship in the First World War, fascism and Nazism in the Second, and communism in the Cold War. That also led to a set of assumptions that effectively we were the good guys and our mission in the world was a good one. The demographic change in the U.S. in this century cannot be overstated. If you are in a country where maybe there's 10 to 15% foreign-born and you have seen the political upheaval that causes, the United States is moving from a country where for the first 250 years of its history, it was, again, 85 to 95% European-American. I use European-American because white is a highly constructed category and includes North Africans on the census. But these are people whose background is European. From essentially 2000 to about 2045, you are moving from that percentage to a society in which there is no one ethnic or religious majority, where European Americans are somewhere around 48%, as best we can tell. Hispanic Americans are 30%. African Americans may be between 10 and 15%. Asian Americans, another 6%. And all of that is going to be subject to a steadily growing mixed race identity. That change has been your linguistic and cultural heritage comes from another part of the world. Your historical life experience, so that of your parents and your relatives, comes from another part of the world. How you see the world in terms of central countries and the geography changes. Pretty much all those assumptions that European Americans took for granted are now increasingly going to be up for grabs.
So could you talk a bit more about the East Coast foreign policy elite? So who is this group and how did they come to gain so much influence over foreign policy making specifically?
Well, the group traditionally were fairly patrician, not surprisingly, because to have the kind of education you needed to then be statesmen, which a lot of the members of this elite were lawyer statesmen or diplomats themselves, those are fairly patrician professions. So this is a well-to-do class that, again, educated at top schools, very Anglophile. Indeed, at the earlier part of the 20th century, as many of us know from Downton Abbey and other similar kinds of comedies, you had wealthy Americans marrying into the British aristocracy to rescue great houses, but also an American fascination with Britain and the British aristocracy. Through the course of the century, it's less that than, again, fighting World War II together, U.S.-British special relationship, being there at the dawn of the European Union, supporting the European Union and helping rebuild Germany and strengthening ties with all of Europe through the Marshall Plan as a way of fighting the Soviet Union. Lots and lots of ties. The languages that any good diplomat would speak would include French, probably in German, Chinese, even Spanish, the other languages, Russian. Those were the more exotic languages. During the Cold War, more people spoke Russian, but French was a given and probably another European language. So the assumptions were economically and politically, the West, whether that famous term, the West, it's very hard to identify the U.S. and Europe as the West. Depends where you're sitting on the globe. But what that meant was Western civilization, white civilization. And then other countries were sort of honorary members. Obviously, Japan, then Korea, Australia, and Canada, yes, because of Anglo-Saxon roots. But that sense that that was the center of the world and the core of the 20th century post-war international order. If you look at the Security Council of the United Nations, those are the victors of World War II. There is France, Britain, and the U.S., really not because of size of country, but because of the alliance. And then you're adding China and Russia. That does not remotely reflect the world that we have today.
So how has the current Trump administration differed in its approach to foreign policy making? And do the East Coast elites you've been talking about still play a significant role in that process?
Trump is very much a transitional figure here, and the Trump administration and Trump supporters. And I would not draw a straight line between the decline of the East Coast elite and the rise of populism. The rise of right-wing populism in the United States is definitely connected to our demographic change. As we see in Europe, many European Americans feel like they don't necessarily recognize their country, that we are multicolor, multiracial, multireligious. The food is different. The culture is different. Many Americans embrace that, and many Americans feel that their traditional way of life and their sense of what their country is and stands for, which was a white Christian nation, is under threat. Those things are intertwined, but they're intertwined with other factors as well. It's Obama who describes what I would call as the East Coast foreign policy, again, elite or establishment. It's Obama who calls that the blob. And that's not that surprising because Obama grew up in Hawaii and is half African and he's half Kenyan. And I happened to be in Kenya shortly after Queen Elizabeth died. In the United States, there was mourning, at least the parts of the United States where I live and up and down the East Coast, but I think really across the United States. But in Kenya, Britain is regarded still as an imperial power and very different set of views. Obama grew up in Indonesia. He had a post-colonial mindset in many ways. That is much closer to what many Americans, if you're Indian American, if you are Chinese American, if you are Latin American of any kind, you are seeing the United States as an imperial power. You may admire it in lots of ways, but your sense of its role in the world is very different. And your sense that transatlantic ought to mean Europe and the U.S., why exactly? Why doesn't that mean Latin America and Africa? Or for that matter, the United States and Africa or Europe and Latin America. So the perspectives are different. And the automatic assumption that European wars are global wars, we saw that tested directly, still being tested directly with the war in Ukraine, where countries like India, whom the United States has been courting, said, that's your problem. We're buying oil from Russia. So the Trump administration, it reflects change. It reflects disruption. It reflects, and particularly this is Trump himself, a preference for a certain amount of chaos. It doesn't necessarily, in fact, I do not think it represents where U.S. foreign policy is going to land over the decades in this century, but it is very much a we're ripping up old assumptions.
So what are the consequences of the demographic shifts we're seeing in America and you've been talking about? What are they likely to have for the future of U.S. policymaking?
In many ways, it's impossible to tell, particularly, as I said, as Americans themselves become more and more mixed in all sorts of ways. It's very hard to know if you have a Finnish father and a Peruvian mother and you were actually raised in the United States. You may have been educated somewhere else. Very hard to know where you're going to land. But I think we can see a couple of pretty clear trends. The largest group after European Americans will be Hispanic American, which is again a ridiculous constructed category because, of course, it includes anyone from Spain or Portugal and anyone from Central or Latin America. And many Hispanic Americans have been in the United States longer than European Americans have, generally from Mexico or from Spain, but that is European. However, they are going to look south. So you can assume that 30% of the United States population is going to have roots in Mexico, Central America, or South America. If you look at trade and investment flows now, it's always the biggest between the U.S. and Europe. And of course it is. That's where Americans came from. Those are the languages we spoke. Those are the deep cultural and human ties. And economic ties tend to follow. So you are going to see much greater integration economically, much greater interest politically, and much greater cultural flows, which actually, when you're in Texas or California or Arizona, you already see. And then, of course, in Miami, many people call Miami the capital of Latin America. For Europeans, that's something very, very unusual. That is not what Europeans think of when they think of the United States, but that's coming. So that's a very big change. I also expect a whole new set of relationships with Africa. The diaspora group that is flourishing the most right now in the United States are Nigerian Americans. And again, as happened with Europe, a lot of very entrepreneurial Africans who already have some family members in the United States are getting educated in the United States and then emigrating. Even now, of course, we're closing our borders, but we've done that traditionally through history. So I expect lots of country ties. Nigeria is a big, powerful country. I expect you will see much more of that. I think you already see that with Middle Eastern countries and various American cities and specific areas. And then, of course, on the West Coast, Asia is already to the West Coast what Europe has been to the East Coast. And the West Coast, California is the fourth largest economy in the world.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
Taking the view from outside of the US now, how might or even should other countries adapt or react to the demographic shift occurring in the US, if at all?
I think particularly for Europeans, and maybe indeed for, again, in air quotes, the West, it's very important to understand that 20th century America, of which Biden's administration was the apotheosis in many ways, because Biden himself had been the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee through the second half of the Cold War. He had been a figure shaped by exactly that sense of global leadership. Remember, he said America is back, because in his view and the view of his administration, we were still the indispensable nation and we were the nation that other nations looked to for leadership. I think those habits need to be undone on the part of many countries. It is not that they should not have close ties with the United States, and the United States will go through a number of iterations till there's anything like a settling of a set of assumptions, but they should basically interrogate the U.S. and U.S. policy the way they would look at not a new country, but not the country they've known. And not just as, oh, we can't rely on the United States, they're isolationists, because that has been the oscillation, isolationism to interventionism. No. What you're more likely to see is perhaps a sudden focus on India and Kashmir, because we have a very powerful Indian American diaspora, and many of those people are in foreign policy. Again, you cannot assume, I'm half Belgian, so you can't assume I'm going to like everything Belgium does. Quite the contrary, I'm going to be extra critical to try to be objective. Still, there's a sort of resonance there, not just for Belgium, but for the EU and for Europe as a whole. You are going to see that. You're going to see that with Marco Rubio right now and the way he thinks about Latin America. So countries ought to be tracking demographic trends. They ought to be tracking just the differences in who's up and who's in the Senate or the House and the Foreign Relations Committee. What are their background assumptions likely to be? And then learn rather than assume.
So in a recent article for the Financial Times, you wrote that if you're a business person, you should read DEI as being short for a demographic and economic imperative. What did you mean by this?
I meant exactly what I'm talking about, that if you are any business and you understand that your customers are moving from a European-American group to a Hispanic, African-American, Asian-American group, you aren't going to make automatic assumptions about what those customers want, or at least you shouldn't. You should avoid stereotyping. But you should also assume that you need to actually find out and adapt to selling into that market. And so what I was saying to global business is, if this is what the United States is becoming, and again, Americans under 30 by 2027, just 2 years away, will already be with that profile. There will already be no one ethnic or religious majority. So you should be hiring a range of folks. You should be studying a range of folks. You should be testing and polling and marketing to a range of folks, because these are your customers. And as you think about that in the United States, then you should also be thinking, let's map those networks. Let's map those flows. Let's look at where different groups are trading or buying or being educated, just as you would any changing market.
So I have a follow-up question. It strikes me that a lot of the discourse coming from some aspects of politics in the US, the Republican Party, for example, kind of go against this idea of being open to new customers and new markets, especially if you look at their rhetoric about immigration. How do we square that discourse with the direction the US is now going demographically?
you see it as a reaction and a reaction to a wave that cannot be stopped, because the changes I'm describing are the result of the change in our immigration laws in 1965, certainly 1965 through the early 1990s. And again, if you think of Americans under 30, you're looking back at people who were born in the early 1990s. In the early 1990s, California and Arizona and New Mexico, but particularly California, shut its border with Mexico. And until then, you'd had many, many, many Mexicans migrating back and forth together with agricultural cycles for decades. But when things tightened up, many of those Mexicans did not go back. And not just Mexicans, but that was the largest group, because they were afraid they couldn't get back in. And then they started to spread out across the country. I'm quoting the scholarship of Douglas Massey, who's a sociologist and demographer at Princeton. And so that's actually, ironically, where suddenly places in the Midwest or the South that had never seen a large Latino population suddenly started seeing migrants, in-country migrants. You can't stop these changes. Every time this has happened in the past, we have had this kind of reaction, massive reactions in the late 19th century. The Know-Nothing Party was completely opposed to immigration. And interestingly then, many people know this, it was the Irish and the Italians who were Catholic. And for Northern European Protestants, we always talk about WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, as our sort of aristocratic culture. Having Irish or Italians or Eastern European, that created just as violent a reaction as people from around the world do today. So expect lots of turbulence, but do not expect it to last.
In your 2004 book, A New World Order, you argued that an era of global governance through government networks is already here. Could you talk about how that system of governance works and what changes might have occurred in the last two decades since you wrote the book?
So government networks are networks of government officials who are not heads of state or foreign ministers. So they are easiest to see in the economic sector. You started with the Basel Committee of Central Bankers. Then you had committees of finance ministers. Indeed, the G20 was originally 20 finance ministers who came together after the East Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. You had the International Organization of Securities Commissioners and the International Associations of Insurance Supervisors. These were networks of the ministers of powerful countries or countries who were focused on the same set of problems. Indeed, the EU was really comprised of these networks. And what I was arguing was, yes, look at the IMF and the World Bank, but pay a lot of attention to these central bankers and finance ministers and other finance regulators, because their networks are just as important as the official organization. That was 2004. That phenomenon has only grown. Now we have the Financial Stability Board, which brings all those folks together, the bankers, the insurance supervisors, the securities regulators, and the finance ministers. And the Financial Stability Board, again, it's mostly the West, but it has lots of partners. And those economic or financial regulatory officials have their fingers directly on the pulse of national economies. The same is true of justice ministers. When you're talking about fighting drug flows or international criminals, you want to look to the networks of justice ministers, environmental ministers. And today, given that the formal international organizations are increasingly dysfunctional, if we have another pandemic, will we look at the World Health Organization? I wish we could. There's a lot of expertise there. I will be looking to the networks of health ministers in different continents, the African health ministers, the European health ministers, the Asian health ministers, and ways in which they come together. They're faster, they're more flexible, and again, often if they can agree, they can go back and get that implemented. But it's both exist together, it's just these networks have gotten steadily stronger.
So you've written about the rise of AI as a useful tool for governance networks. Could you talk about how you think countries can integrate these technologies into their systems and into these governance networks?
When you talk about AI, you have to wonder, when did I write that? Because if it was more than a year ago, it's out of date. 6 months ago, it might have been out of date, since now we're all talking about agentic AI, the AI agents that will be the next wave of AI. But I think the broader point is that you can see the rise of the internet as giving people potential access to the world's knowledge. You have to be connected, of course. And then you have to have access to great libraries. It's not just Google. It's all the more specialized bodies of knowledge that have been digitized that different sectors use. So a good example, Bloomberg for business. If you have access to Bloomberg, you have a competitive advantage over businesses that don't. AI can level that playing field quite a bit. Now, again, it of course assumes access and it assumes access to AI tools. But if you look at ChatGPT or Claude or any of their probably 10 and many smaller ones, if you are using the same AI as your fellow governments and you are educated in how to use AI, and again, I would say young people, no matter where they are likely to know how to use AI better than my generation pretty quickly, then you are really providing people with the speed of accumulation and synthesis of knowledge that many poorer countries, many less capable governments simply could not get on their own. There are no magic bullets, and it depends on the humans who use it and how well they know how to use it. But I can imagine within these network structures, the ability to improve government capacity or private or civic sector capacity much more quickly with the help of AI.
So thinking about America's 250th anniversary in 2026, what challenges do you think are the most pressing for U.S. transatlantic relationships in the coming years? And do you think any new ones might appear?
Well, I've been very optimistic thus far because I'm taking a long view of demographic change, technological change, and indeed, I would say global change, the existential global problems like climate change and pandemics. And I've assumed that the United States will remain a strong democracy and that we will survive the present turbulence. That is not an automatic assumption by any means. Certainly, this is the greatest crisis of U.S. democracy in my lifetime, but I would say that's true in my parents' lifetime or my grandparents' lifetime. I was not around for the Civil War, neither were they. So our 250th is the marker of that 250 years as essentially a white Christian European nation to a nation that reflects the entire world with many different cultures, many different connections, just a much more diverse population. It is possible that the ways in which that divide is being manipulated, the ways in which a broader crisis of democracy working for voters, for the populations, the demos, we are seeing not just in the United States, but in Europe and in other countries. The 250th ideally will be a time of recommitment to the values of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address. It's essentially liberty, democracy, equality and justice for all. We need to recommit to those values and we need to radically overhaul our political system so that Americans are fairly represented, which they are not right now. And that goes from electoral systems to campaign finance. We need to overhaul our educational system so that it actually does provide accessible public education to all Americans. We need to overhaul our healthcare system, our way of supporting families. We are at a moment, if not of revolution, but I hope of reinvention. So ideally, the 250th will mark a caesura and a new beginning. It could also and probably will mark a year of military parades and macho breastfeeding and white supremacy. I hope that the way I see the country, and I fervently believe that a majority of my fellow Americans see the country, will prevail.
That's a good place for us to finish. Before we do finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on, or that others are working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. I think if you are interested in the demography questions, you should follow the work of William Frey, F-R-E-Y, at the Brookings Institution. There are others who have written on demographic change, but he's a very sober analyst, but really helps you see the dimensions of this change. I think if you are interested in where we go economically, I would advise just looking at trade and investment. investment flows and looking at how they track diasporas, because that is something, again, people who study international relations don't normally track demographers. I do that. And then I think if you want some hope, but also a lot of realism in what the United States needs, I recommend the writings of Danielle Allen, Justice by Means of Democracy, and also her Substack, The Renovator, also a Substack called The All-American. Lots of Americans who are coming together around American values, embracing the demographic change, but also very much committed to the idea that we leave no American behind.
Thank you. And our listeners can look out for links to those resources in our show notes. It just remains for me to say, Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Anne-Marie Slaughter is the CEO of New America. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Anne-Marie Slaughter for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!